he's demonstrated. What expression is this? Phobos. Fear. Dionyces, schooled in the discipline, commanded his facial muscles to relent. Now, what does this expression indicate? Aphobia. Fearlessness. It seemed effortless when Dionyces did it, and the other boys in their training were practicing and mastering this too, but for Alexandros nothing of the discipline came easy. The only time his heart beat truly without fear was when he mounted the choral stand and stood solitary to sing at the Gymnopedia and the other boys' festivals. Perhaps his true guardians were the muses. Dionyces had Alexandros sacrificed to them and to Zeus and Mnemosyne. Agathe, one of the two looker-sisters of Ariston, made a charm of amber to Polyhymnia. And Alexandros carried it with him, pended from the cross-hatch within his shield. Dionyces encouraged Alexandros in his singing. The gods endow each man with a gift by which he may conquer fear. Alexandros's, Dionyces felt certain, was his voice. Skill in singing in Sparta is counted second only to martial valor, and in fact is closely related, through the heart and lungs, within the discipline of the Phobologia. This is why the Lacedaemonians sing as they advance into battle. They are schooled to open the throat and gulp the air, work the lungs till the accumulators relent and break the constriction of fear. There are two running courses within the city. The Little Ring, which begins at the Gymnasion and follows the Konoura road beneath Athena of the Brazen House, and the Big Ring, which laps all five villages, past Amycle, along the Hyacinthian Way, and across the slopes of Taygetus. Alexandros ran the big one 6 miles barefoot before sacrifice and after dinner mess. Extra rations were slipped him by the Helot cooks. By unspoken compact, the boys of his bua protected him in training. They covered for him when his lungs betrayed him, when it seemed he might be singled out for punishment. Alexandros responded with a secret shame, which propelled him to even greater exertions. He began to train in the all-in, that type of no-holds-barred boys' brawling unique to Lacedaemon, in which the competitor may kick, bite, gouge the eyes, do anything but raise the hand for quarter. Alexandros hurled himself barefoot up the Therai watercourse and bare-handed against the pancratist's bag. He ran weighted sprints, he pounded his fists into the trainer's boxes of sand. His slender hands became scarred and knuckle-busted. His nose broke again and again. He fought boys from his own platoon and others, and he fought me. I was growing fast. My hands were getting stronger. Every athletic action Alexandros performed, I could do better. In the fighting square, it was all I could do not to break up his face even more. He should have hated me, but it was not in him. He shared his surplus rations, and worried that I would be whipped for going easy on him. We talked for hours in secret on the pursuit of esoterike harmonia, that state of self-composure which the exercises of the Phobologia are designed to produce. As a string of the kithara vibrates purely, emitting only that note of the musical scale which is its alone, so must the individual warrior shed all which is superfluous in his spirit, until he himself vibrates at that soul pitch which his individual daimon dictates. The achievement of this ideon in Lacedaemon carries beyond courage on the battlefield. It is considered the supreme embodiment of virtue, Andrea, of a citizen and a man. Beyond esoterike harmonia lies exoterike harmonia, that state of union with one's fellows, which parallels the musical harmony of the multi-stringed instrument, or of the chorus of voices itself. In battle, exoterike harmonia guides the phalanx to move and strike as one man of a single mind and will. In passion, it unites husband to wife, lover to lover, in wordless, perfect union. In politics, exoterica harmonia produces a city of concord and unity, in which each individual, securing his own noblest expression of character, donates this to each other, as obedient to the laws of the commonwealth, as the strings of the kithara to the immutable mathematics of music. In piety, exoterica harmonia produces that silent symphony which most delights the ears of the gods. At the height of that summer, there was a war with the Antirrhionians. 4 of the army's 12 loci were mobilized, reinforced by elements of the Skiritai, the mountain rangers who comprised their own main force regiment, to a call-up of the first 10 age classes, 2,800 in all. This was no force to be taken lightly, all Lacedaemonian, commanded by the king himself. The battle train alone would be half a mile long. It would be the first full-scale campaign since the death of Cleomenes, and the third in which Leonidas would assume command as king. Polyneikes would go as a knight of the king's bodyguard, Olympias with the huntress battalion in the wild olive locos, and Deinochus as a platoon commander and enomatarch in the Heracles. Even Decton, my half-breed friend, would be mobilized as herd boy for the sacrificial beasts. The entire Deucalion mess, in which Alexandros stood too, meaning acted as occasional cup-bearer and server so he could observe his elders and learn, was called up except the 5 eldest men between 40 and 60. For Alexandros, though he was 6 years too young to go, the mobilization seemed to plunge him even more deeply under his cloud. The uncalled-up peers twitched about with their own brand of frustration. The air was touchy and ripe for explosiveness. Somehow an all-in match got started one evening between Alexandros and me, outdoors behind the mess. The peers gathered eagerly. The action was just what they needed. I could hear Deinochus's voice cheering the brawl on. Alexandros seemed full of fire. We were bare-handed, and his smallish fists flew fast as darts. He kicked me hard, to the temple, and followed with a solid elbow to the gut. I dropped. It was a true fall. I was really hurt. But the peers had seen Alexandros's friends cover for him so frequently that they now thought I was tanking it. Alexandros did, too. "Get up, you outlander piece of shit!" He straddled me in the dirt and hit me again when I rose. For the first time I heard real killer instinct in his voice. The peers heard it, too, and raised a shout of delight. Meanwhile, the hounds, of whom there were never fewer than 20 after chow time, howled and bounded from every quarter in the turf-skimming fever that their masters' excited voices now drove them to. I got up and hit Alexandros. I knew I could beat him easily, despite his crowd-impelled fury. I tried to pull my punch just slightly so that no one would notice. They did. A howl of outrage rose from the peers of the mess and others from adjacent Sisitia, who had now clustered, forming a ring from which neither Alexandros nor I could escape. Men's fists cuffed me hard about the ears. "Fight him, you little fucker!" The pack instinct had seized the hounds. They were at the verge of losing themselves to their animal nature. Suddenly, 2 burst into the ring. One got in a nip at Alexandros before the men's sticks sent him scampering. That was it. A spasm of the lungs seized Alexandros. His throat constricted. He began to choke. My punch hesitated. A 3-foot switch burned my back. "Hit him!" I obeyed. Alexandros dropped to one knee. His lungs had frozen. He was helpless. "Pound him, you whore's son!" a voice shouted from behind me. "Finish him!" It was Deinochus. His switch lashed me so hard it drove me to my knees. The delirium of voices overwhelmed the senses, all calling for me to polish Alexandros off. It was not anger at him, nor were they rooting for me. The peers could not have cared less about me. It was for him, to teach him, to make him eat the 1,000th bitter lesson of the 10,000 more he would endure before they hardened him into the rock the city demanded and allowed him to take his place as an equal and a warrior. Alexandros knew it and rose with the fury of desperation, choking for breath. He charged like a boar. I felt the lash. I swung with everything I had. Alexandros spun and dropped, face first into the dirt, blood and spittle slinging from the side of his mouth. He lay there, motionless as a dead man. The peer's shouting ceased instantly. Only the ungodly racket of the hounds continued at its maddening, shrill pitch. Dianeces stepped across to the fallen form of his protégé and knelt to feel his heart. In unconsciousness, Alexandros's breath returned. Dianeces's hand scraped the sputum from the boy's lips. "What are you gaping at?" he barked at the circling peers. "It's over. Let him be." The army marched out next morning for Antirion. Leonidas strode at the fore in full panoplia, including slung shield with his brow wreathed and his plumeless, unadorned helmet riding the rolled battle pack atop his scarlet cloak, his long steel-colored hair immaculately dressed and falling to his shoulders. About him marched the companion guard of the knights, a half-call-up 150, with Polyneikes in the fore-rank of honor beside 6 other Olympic victors. They marched not rigidly nor in grim, silent lockstep, but at ease, talking and joking with one another and their families and friends along the roadside. Leonidas himself, were it not for his years and station of honor, could easily have been mistaken for a common infantryman, so unprepossessing was his armament, so nonchalant his demeanor. Yet all the city knew that this march out, as the 2 previous beneath his command, was driven by his will and his will alone. It was aimed at the Persian invasion the king knew would come, perhaps not this year, perhaps not 5 years from now, but surely and inevitably. The twin ports of Rion and Antirion commanded the western approach to the Gulf of Corinth. This avenue threatened the Peloponnese and all of central Greece. Rion, the near side port, stood already within the Spartan hegemony. She was an ally. But Antirion, across the strait, remained haughtily aloof, thinking herself beyond the reach of Lacedaemonian power. Leonidas meant to show her the error of her ways. He would bring her to heel and bottle up the gulf, protecting central Hellas from Persian sea assault, at least from the northwest. Alexandros's father, Olympias, marched past at the head of the Wild Olive Regiment with Meriones, the 50-year-old battle captive and former Potidaean captain, beside him as his squire. This gentle fellow possessed a grand beard, white as snow. He used to secrete little treasures within its bushy nest and pluck them forth as surprise gifts for Alexandros and his sisters when they were children. He did this now, straying to the roadside to place in Alexandros's hand a tiny iron charm in the shape of a shield. Meriones clasped the boy's hand with a wink and moved on. I stood in the crowd before the Hellenion with Alexandros and the other boys of the training platoons, the women and children, the whole city drawn up beneath the acacias and cypresses, singing the hymn to Castor as the regiments trooped out along the going-away street with their shields slung and spears at the slope, helmets lashed athwart the shoulders of their crimson cloaks, bobbing atop their polemothalakioi, the battle-packs, which the peers bore now for show, but which, like their armor, would be transferred with all kit save spears and swords to the shoulders of their squires when the army assumed column of march and stripped for the long, dusty hump north. Alexandros's beautiful broken face remained a mask, as Dianeces strode into view, flanked by his squire, Suicide, at the head of his platoon of the Heracles Locos. The main body of troops passed on. Leading and accompanying each regiment trudged the pack animals, laden with the supplies of the commissariat, and thwacked merrily on the rumps by the switches of their helot herd-boys. The train of armament wagons passed next, already obscured within a churning storm of road dust. Then followed the tall victualling wagons, with their cargo of oil pots and wine jars, sacks of figs, olives, leeks, onions, pomegranates, and the cooking pots and ladles swinging on hooks beneath them, banging into each other musically in the dust of the mule's tread, contributing a ringing metronomic air to the cacophony of cracking whips and squalling wheel rims, teamsters' balls and groaning axles. Behind the provisions-bearers came the portable forges and armorers' kits with their spare xiphos blades and butt-spikes, lizard-stickers, and long iron spear-blades. Then the spare eight-footers, uncured ash and cornel shafts, lashed lengthwise along the wagon-rails. Helot armorers strode in the cloud alongside, clad in their dog-skin caps and aprons, forearms crisscrossed with the burn scars of the smithy. Last of all trooped the sacrificial goats and sheep, with their horns wrapped and leashes held by the helot herd urchins, led by Dekton in his already road-begrimed altar-boy white, trailering a haltered ass laden with feed grain and two victory roosters in cages, one on either side of the cargo frame. He grinned when he passed, a little flash of contempt escaping his otherwise impeccably pious demeanor. I was deep into slumber that night on the stone of the portico behind the ephorate when I felt a hand shake me awake. It was Agathe, the Spartan girl who had made Alexandros's charm to Polyhymnia. "Get up, you!" she hissed, so as not to alert the score of other youths of the Agoge asleep and on watch around these public buildings. I blinked around. Alexandros, who had been asleep beside me, was gone.
"Hurry!"
The girl melted at once into shadow. I followed her swiftly through the dark streets to that copse of the double-boled myrtle they called Dioscuri, the twins, just west of the start of the little ring. Alexandros was there. He had snuck away from his platoon without me, which would have put both of us, if caught, in line for a merciless whipping. He stood now, wearing his black pais cloak and battle-pack, confronted by his mother, the Lady Paralia, one of their male house-helots, and his two younger sisters. Hard words flew. Alexandros intended to follow the army to battle. "I'm going," he declared. "Nothing will stop me." I was ordered by Alexandros's mother to knock him down. I saw something flash in his fist. His xiele, the sickle-like weapon all the boys carried. The women saw it, too, and the deadly grim look in the lad's eye. For a long moment every form froze. The preposterousness of the situation was becoming more and more apparent, as was the adamantine resolution of the boy. His mother straightened before him. "Go, then," the Lady Paralia addressed her son at last. She didn't need to add that I would go with him. "And may God preserve you in the lashing you receive when you return." Chapter 10. It was not hard to follow the army. The track along the Enus was churned to dust ankle-deep. At Silesia, the Perioikic Stephanos regiment had joined the expedition. Alexandros and I, arriving in the dark, could still make out the trodden, bare marshalling ground and the freshly dried blood upon the altar where the sacrifices had been performed and the omens taken. The army itself was half a day ahead. We could not stop for sleep, but pushed on all night. At dawn we came upon men we recognized. A helot armorer named Eucrates had broken his leg in a fall and was being helped home by two of his fellows. He informed us that at the frontier fort of Oion, intelligence had reached Leonidas. The Antirionians, far from rolling over and playing dead as the king had hoped, had sent envoys in secret, appealing for aid to the tyrannous Gilon in Sicilia. Gilon could appreciate as well as Leonidas and the Persians the strategic indispensability of the port of Antirion. He wanted it too. 40 Syracusan ships, bearing 2,000 citizen and mercenary heavy infantry, were on their way to reinforce the Antirionian defenders. It would be a real battle after all. The Spartan force pressed on through Tegea. The Tegeaites, member allies of the Peloponnesian League, and obligated to follow the Spartans whithersoever they should lead, reinforced the army with 600 of their own heavy infantry, swelling its fighting total to beyond 4,000. Leonidas had not been seeking parataxis, a pitched battle with the Antirrhionians. Rather, he had hoped to overawe them with a show of such force that they would perceive the folly of defiance and enroll themselves of their own free will in the alliance against the Persians. Among Decton's herd was a wrapped bull, brought in anticipation of celebration, of festive sacrifice in honor of this new addition to the league. But the Antirrhionians, perhaps bought by Gilon's gold, inflamed by the rhetoric of some glory-hungry demagogue or betrayed by a lying oracle, had chosen to make a fight of it. When Alexandros spoke to the Helots on the road, he had queried them for intelligence on the specific makeup of the Syracusan forces, which units, under which commanders, reinforced by which auxiliaries. The Helots didn't know. In any army other than the Spartan, such ignorance would have provoked a fierce tongue-lashing or worse. Yet Alexandros let it go without a thought. Among the Lacedaemonians it is considered a matter of indifference of whom and in what the enemy consists. The Spartans are schooled to regard the foe, any foe, as nameless and faceless. In their minds it is the mark of an ill-prepared and amateur army to rely in the moments before battle on what they call pseudo-andrea, false courage, meaning the artificially inflated martial frenzy produced by a general's 11th-hour harangue or some peak of bronze-banging bravado built to by shouting, shield-pounding, and the like. In Alexandros's mind, which already at age 14 mirrored that of the generals of his city, one Syracusan was as good as the next. One enemy strategos no different from another. Let the foe be Mantinean, Olynthian, Epidaurian, let him come in elite units or hordes of shrieking rabble, crack citizen regiments or foreign mercenaries hired for gold. It made no difference. None was a match for the warriors of Lacedaemon, and all knew it. Among the Spartans, the work of war is demystified and depersonalized through its vocabulary, which is studded with references both agrarian and obscene. Their word, which I translated earlier as fuck, as in the youth's tree-fucking, bears the connotation not so much of penetration as of grinding, like a miller's stone. The front three ranks fuck or mill the enemy. The verb to kill, in Doric, theros, is the same as to harvest. The warriors in the fourth through sixth ranks are sometimes called harvesters, both for the work they do on the trampled enemy with the butt-spike lizard-stickers of their eight-footers, and for that pitiless threshing stroke they make with the short xiphos sword, which itself is often called a reaper. To decapitate a man is to top him off or give him a haircut. Chopping off a hand or arm is called limbing. Alexandros and I arrived at Rion, at the bluff overlooking the army's embarkation port, a little after midnight of the third day. The port lights of Antirrhion shone, clearly visible across the narrow strait. The embarkation beaches were already packed with men and boys, women and children, a thronging festive mob gathered to watch the spectacle of the fleet of galleys and coasters. Conscripted merchantmen, ferries and even fishing boats assembled in advance of the allied Rionians to transport the army in darkness west along the coast, out of sight of Antirrhion, then across the gulf where it stood widest, some 5 miles down. Leonidas, respecting the sea-fighting reputation of the Antirrhionians, had elected to make this passage at night. Among the bluff-top farewell ballers, Alexandros and I located a boy our age, whose father, he claimed, owned a fast smack and would not be averse to pocketing the wad of Attic drachmas clutched in Alexandros's fist in exchange for a swift, silent crossing, no questions asked. The boy led us down through the crush of spectators and merrymakers to an obscure launching beach called the Ovens behind an unlighted breakwater. Not 20 minutes after the last Spartan transport had cast off, we were on the water too, trailing the fleet, out of sight to the west. I fear the sea any time, but never more than on a moonless night and in the hands of strangers. Our captain had insisted on bringing along his two brothers, though a man and a boy could easily handle the light, swift craft. I have known these coasters and man-jacks and mistrust them. The brothers, if indeed that's what they were hulking louts, barely capable of speech, with beards so dense they began just below the eye-line and extended thick as fur to the matted pelts of their chests. An hour passed. The smack was making far too much speed. Across the dark water the plash of the transport's oar-blades and even the creaking of looms against thole-pins carried easily. Alexandros ordered the pirate twice to retard his progress, but the man tossed it off with a laugh. "We were downwind," he said. "No one could hear us. And even if they did, they would take us for part of the convoy or one of the spectator boats trailing to catch the action." Sure enough, as soon as the belly of the coastline had swallowed the lights of Rion behind us, a Spartan cutter emerged out of the black and made way to intercept us. Doric voices hailed the smack and ordered her to heave to. Suddenly our skipper demanded his money. "When we land," Alexandros insisted, as agreed. The beards clamped oars in their fists like weapons. "Cutter's getting closer, boys. How will it go with you if you're caught?" "Give him nothing, Alexandros," I hissed. But the boy perceived the precariousness of our predicament. "Of course, Captain. It will be my pleasure." The pirate accepted his fare, grinning like Charon on the ferry to hell. "Now, lads, over the side with you." We were smack in the middle of the widest part of the gulf. Our boatman indicated the Spartan cutter bearing swiftly down. "Catch a line and keep under the stern while I feed these lubbers a yard of shit." The beards loomed. "Soon as we talk these fools off, we'll haul you back aboard, none the worse for wear." Over we went. Up came the cutter. We heard the scrape of a knife blade through rope. The line came off in our hands. "Happy landings, lads!" In a flash, the smack steering oar bit deep into the swell. The two worthless brutes suddenly showed themselves anything but. Three swift heaves on the driving oars, and the smack shot off like a sling bullet. We were cast adrift in the middle of the channel. The cutter came up, calling after the smack as she sped from sight. The Spartans still hadn't seen us. Alexandros clamped my arm. "We must not sing out. That would mean dishonor." "I agree. Drowning's a lot more honorable." "Shut up." We held silent, treading water while the cutter quartered the area, scanning for other craft that might be spies. Finally, she showed her stern and rowed off. We were alone beneath the stars. As vast as the sea can look from the deck of a ship, it looks even bigger from a single handbreadth above the surface. "Which shore do we make for?" Alexandros gave me a look as if I had lost my senses. Of course we would go forward. We paddled for what seemed like hours. The shore had not crawled one spear length closer. "What if the current's against us? For all we know, we're stuck here in place or even drifting backward." "We're closer," Alexandros insisted. "Your eyes must be better than mine." There was nothing to do but paddle and pray. What monsters of the sea prowled at this moment beneath our feet, ready to snare our legs in their horrible coils or shear us off at the kneecaps? I could hear Alexandros gulp water, fighting an asthmatic fit. We pulled closer together. Our eyes were gumming up from the salt. Our arms felt like lead. "Tell me a story," Alexandros said. For a moment I feared he was going mad. "To encourage each other, keep our spirits up. Tell me a story." I recited some verses from the Iliad, which Bruxius had made Diomache and me commit to memory, our second summer in the hills. I was getting the hexameters out of order, but Alexandros didn't care. The words seemed to fortify him greatly. "Dianeke says the mind is like a house with many rooms," he said. "There are rooms one must not go into. To anticipate one's death is one of those rooms. We must not allow ourselves even to think it." He instructed me to continue, selecting only verses of valor. He declared that we must under no circumstances give thought to failure. "I think the gods may have dropped us here on purpose, to teach us about those rooms." We paddled on. Orion the hunter had stood overhead when we began. Now his arc descended halfway down the sky. The shore stood as far off as ever. "Do you know Agathe, Ariston's sister?" Alexandros asked out of nowhere. "I'm going to marry her. I've never told anyone that." "Congratulations. You think I'm joking, but my thoughts have kept coming back to her for hours, or however long we've been out here." He was serious. "Do you think she'll have me?" It made as much sense to debate this in the middle of the ocean as anything else. Your family outranks hers. If your father asks, hers will have to say yes. I don't want her that way. You've watched her. Tell me the truth. Will she have me? I considered it. "She made you that amber charm. Her eyes never leave you when you sing. She comes out to the big ring with her sisters when we run. She pretends to be training, but she's really sneaking looks at you." This seemed to cheer Alexandros mightily. "Let's make a push. 20 minutes as strong as we can and see how far we can get." When we hit 20, we decided to try for another. "You have a girl you love too, don't you?" Alexandros asked as we paddled. "From your city, the girl you lived in the hills with, your cousin who went to Athens." I said it was impossible that he could know all that. He laughed. "I know everything. I hear it from the girls and the goat boys and from your helot friend, Decton." He said he wanted to know more about this girl of yours. I told him I wouldn't tell him. "I can help you to see her. My great uncle is Proxenos for Athens. He can have her found and brought to the city if you wish." The swells were getting bigger. A cold wind had gotten up. We were going nowhere. I supported Alexandros again as another choking fit attacked him. He stuck his thumb between his teeth and bit through the flesh till it bled. The pain seemed to steady him. "Dianeke says that warriors advancing into battle must speak steadily and calmly to each other, each man encouraging his mate. We have to keep talking, Zio." The mind plays tricks and conditions of such extremity. I cannot tell how much I spoke aloud to Alexandros over the succeeding hours, and how much simply swam before memory's eye as we labored endlessly toward the shore that refused to come closer. I know I told him of Bruxius. If my knowledge of Homer were worthy, all credit lay with this fortune-cursed man, sightless as the poet himself, and his fierce will that I and my cousin not grow to adulthood wild and unlettered in the hills. "This man was mentor to you," Alexandros pronounced gravely, "as Dianeke's is to me." He wished to hear more. What was it like to lose mother and father, to watch your city burn? How long did you and your cousin remain in the hills? How did you get food? And how protect yourself from the elements and wild beasts? In gulps and snatches, I told him. By our second summer in the mountains, Diomache and I had become such accomplished hunters that not only did we no longer need to descend to town or farm for food, we no longer wished to. We were happy in the hills. Our bodies were growing. We had meat not once or twice a month or on festival occasions only, as in our fathers' houses, but every day, with every meal. Here was our secret. We had found dogs. 2 puppies, to be exact, runts of a disowned litter. Arcadian shepherd's hounds we had discovered shivering and suckling blind, abandoned by their mother, who had untimely given birth in midwinter. We named one happy and the other lucky, and they were. By spring, both had legs to run, and by summer, their instincts had made them hunters. With those dogs, our hungry days were over. We could track and kill anything that breathed. We could sleep with both eyes closed and know that nothing could take us unawares. We became such a proficient hunting team, Dio and I, and the hounds, that we actually passed up opportunities, came upon game and let it go with the benevolence of gods. We feasted like lords and viewed the sweating valley farmers and plodding highland goatherds with contempt. Bruxius began to fear for us. We were growing wild, cityless. In evenings past, Bruxius had recited Homer and made it a game how many verses we could repeat without a slip. Now this exercise took on a deadly earnestness for him. He was failing, we all knew it. He would not be with us much longer. Everything he knew he must pass on. Homer was our school, the Iliad and Odyssey, the texts of our curriculum. Over and over Bruxius had us recite the verses upon Odysseus's return, when, clad in rags and unrecognizable as the rightly lord of Ithaca, the hero of Troy seeks shelter at the hut of Eumaeus, the swineherd. Though Eumaeus has no idea that the traveler at his gate is his true king, and thinks him only another cityless beggar, yet out of respect to Zeus, who protects the wayfarer, he invites the wanderer kindly in and shares with him his humble fare. This was humility, hospitality, graciousness toward the stranger. We must imbibe it, sink it deep within our bones. Bruxius tutored us relentlessly in compassion, that virtue which he saw diminishing each day within our mountain-hardened hearts. We were made to recite the tent scene at the close of the Iliad, when Priam of Troy kneels before Achilles to kiss in supplication the hand of the man who has slain his sons, including the mightiest and dearest to him, Hector, hero and protector of Ilium. Then Bruxius grilled us upon it. What would we have done were we Achilles? Were we Priam? Was each man's action proper and pious in the eyes of the gods? We must have a city, Bruxius declared. Without a city we were no better than the wild brutes we hunted and killed. Athens. There, Bruxius insisted, was where Dio and I must go. The city of Athena was the only truly open city in Hellas, her freest and most civilized. The love of wisdom, philosophia, was esteemed in Athens beyond all other pursuits. The life of the mind was cultivated and honored, invigorated by a high culture of theater, music, poetry, architecture, and the arts. Nor were the Athenians inferior to any city in Hellas in the practice of war. The Athenians welcomed immigrants. A bright, strong boy like me could take a trade, indenture himself in a shop. And Athens had a fleet. Even with my crippled hands, I could pull an oar. With my skill with the bow, I could become a toxotes, a marine archer, distinguish myself in war, and exploit that service to advance my position. Athens, too, was where Diomache must go. As a well-spoken freeborn, and with her blooming beauty, she could find service in a respected house and attract no shortage of admirers. She was at just the right age for a bride. It was far from a stretch to imagine her securing betrothal to a citizen. As the wife even of a metic, a resident alien, she could protect me, aid me in securing employment. And we would have each other. As Bruxius's strength diminished with the passing weeks, his conviction intensified that we follow his will in these matters. He made us swear that when his time came, we would go down from the hills and make for Attica, to the city of Athena. In October of that second year, Dio and I hunted one long, cold-coming day and killed nothing. We tramped back into camp, grumbling at each other, anticipating a mean porridge of mixed pulse and mountain peas, and worse, the sight of Bruxius, whose slackening constitution was each day becoming more painful to behold, maintaining that all was well with him. He did not need meat. We saw his smoke and watched the dogs bound up the hill as they loved to, sprinting to their friend to receive his hugs and homecoming roughhouse. From the trail's turn below the camp we heard their barking. Not the usual squeals of play, but something keener, more insistent. Happy scrambled into view 100 feet above us. Diomache looked at me, and we both knew. It took an hour to build Bruxius's pyre. When his gaunt, slave-branded body lay at last within the purifying flame, I lit a pitched arrow from the hollow above his heart and loosed it, flaming with all my strength, arcing like a comet down the dark valley. Then aged Nestor, peerless in wisdom among the flowing-haired Achaeans, laid himself down in the fullness of years and closed his eyes as if in sleep, slain by Artemis's gentle darts. 10 dawns later, Diomache and I stood at the three-cornered way, on the frontier of Attica and Megara, where the Athens road breaks off to the east, the sacred road to Delphi in the west, and the Corinthian southwest to the Isthmus and the Peloponnese. No doubt we looked like the most savage pair of ragamuffins, barefoot, faces scorched by the sun, our long hair tied in horse-tails behind us. Both of us carried daggers and bows, and the dogs loped beside us, as burr-coated and filthy as we were. Traffic lumbered through the three corners, the pre-dawn vehicles, freighters and produce wagons, firewood haulers, farm urchins on their way to market with their cheeses and eggs and sacks of onions, just as Dio and I had started out for Asticus that morning that seemed so long ago, and yet was only 2 winters by the calendar. We halted at the crossroads and asked directions. Yes, a teamster pointed. Athens was that way, 2 hours, no more. My cousin and I had barely spoken on the week-long tramp down from the mountains. We were thinking of cities and what our new life would be like. I watched the other travelers when they passed on the highway, how they eyed her. The need was on her to be a woman. "I want babies," she said out of the blue, the last day as we marched. "I want a husband to care for and to care for me. I want a home, I don't care how humble, just some place I can have a little garden, put flowers on the sill and make it pretty for my husband and our children." This was her way of being kind to me, of drawing a distance beforehand so I would have time to absorb it. "Can you understand, Zio?" I understood. "Which dog do you want?" "Don't be cross with me. I'm only trying to tell you how things are and how they must be." We decided she would take Lucky, and I would keep Happy. "We can stay together in the city," she thought out loud as we walked. "We'll tell the people we're brother and sister. But you must understand, Zio, if I find a decent man, someone who will treat me with respect..." "I understand. You can stop talking now." 2 days before, a gentlewoman of Athens had passed us on the highway, traveling by coach with her husband and a merry party of friends and servants. The lady had been taken by the sight of this wild girl, Diomache, and insisted upon having her serving women bathe and oil her and dress her hair. She wanted to do mine, too, but I wouldn't let them near me. Their whole party stopped by a shaded stream, and entertained themselves with cakes and wine while the maids took Dio away and groomed her. When my cousin emerged, I didn't recognize her. The Athenian lady was beside herself with delight. She couldn't stop praising Dio's charms, nor anticipating the stir her blossoming beauty would create among the young bloods of the city. The lady insisted that Dio and I proceed straight to her husband's home the moment we arrived in Athens. She would look to our employment and the continuation of our schooling. Her manservant would await us at the Thriasian gates. Just ask anyone. We tramped on that last long day. On the freighters that passed now, we could read the words Phaleron and Athens scrawled on the destination bands of serried wine jars and crated merchandise. Accents were becoming Attic. We stopped to watch a troop of Athenian cavalry out on a lark. 4 seamen marched past, heading for the city, each balancing his oar upon his shoulder and carrying his strap and cushion. That would be me before long. Always in the hills, Dio and I had slept in each other's arms, not as lovers, but for warmth. These final nights on the road, she wrapped herself in her own cloak and took her sleep apart. At last we arrived at dawn before the Three Corners. I had stopped and was watching a freight wagon pass. I could feel my cousin's eyes upon me. "You're not coming, are you?"
I said nothing.
She knew which fork I would be taking. "Bruxius will be angry with you," she said.
Dio and I had learned, from the dogs and on the hunt, how to communicate with just a look. I told her goodbye with my eyes and begged her to understand. She would be well cared for in this city. Her life as a woman was just beginning.
"The Spartans will be cruel to you," Diomache said.
The dogs paced impatiently at our feet. They did not yet know that they were parting too. Dio took my hands in both of hers.
"And will we never sleep in each other's arms again, cousin?"
It must have seemed a queer spectacle to the teamsters and farm boys passing, the sight of these two wild children embracing upon the roadside, with their slung bows and daggers and their cloaks bound into travelers' rolls upon their backs. Diomache took her road, and I took mine. She was 15. I was 12. How much of this I imparted to Alexandros in those hours in the water, I cannot say. Dawn had still not shown her face when I finished. We were clinging to a miserable floating spar, barely big enough to support one, and too exhausted to swim another stroke. The water was getting colder. Hypothermia gripped our limbs. I heard Alexandra's cough and sputter, struggling for the strength to speak.
"We have to quit this spar. If we don't, we'll die."
My eyes strained toward the north. Peaks could be made out, but the shore itself remained invisible. Alexandra's cold hand clasped mine.
"Whatever happens," he swore, "I will not abandon you."
He let go of the spar. I followed. An hour later, we collapsed like Odysseus on a rock beach beneath a bawling rookery. We gulped fresh water from a cliff wall spring, washed the salt from our hair and eyes, and knelt in thanksgiving for our deliverance. For half the morning we slept like the dead. I climbed for eggs, which we wolfed raw from the shell, standing on the sand in the rags of our garments.
"Thank you, my friend," Alexandros said very quietly.
He extended his hand. I took it.
"Thank you, too."
The sun stood near its zenith. Our salt, stiff cloaks had dried upon our backs.
"Let's get moving," Alexandros said. "We've lost half a day."
Chapter 11. The battle took place on a dusty plain to the west of the city of Antirion, within bowshot of the beach and immediately beneath the citadel walls. A desultory stream, the Acanathos, meandered across the plain, bisecting it at the midpoint. Perpendicular to this watercourse, along the seaward flank, the Antirionians had thrown up a crude battle wall. Rugged hills sealed the enemy's left. A portion of the plain adjacent the wall was occupied by a maritime junkyard. Rotting craft lay littered at all angles, extending halfway across the field, amid tumble-down work shacks and stinking mounds of debris squalled over by wheeling flocks of gulls. In addition, the enemy had strewn boulders and driftwood to break up the flat over which Leonidas and his men must advance. Their own side, the foe's, had been cleared smooth as a schoolmaster's desk. When Alexandros and I scurried breathless and tardy upon the site, the Spartan Scyrtai rangers had just finished setting the enemy refuse yards ablaze. The armies yet stood in formation, 2/5 of a mile apart, with the burning hulks between them.
All native merchantmen and fishing craft had been withdrawn by the enemy, either hauled to safety within the fortified portion of the anchorage or standing offshore beyond the invaders' reach. This did not deter the Skiritai from torching the wharves and warehouses of the harbor. The timbers of the shipsheds the rangers had saturated with naphtha. Already they blazed in ruins to the waterline. The defenders of Antirion, as Leonidas and the Spartans well knew, were militiamen, farmers and potters and fishermen, summertime soldiers, like my father. The devastation of their harbor was meant to unnerve them, to dislocate their faculties unaccustomed to such sights, and sear into their unseasoned senses the stink and scourge of coming slaughter. It was morning, about market time, and the shore breeze had gotten up. Black smoke from the careened wrecks began to obscure the field. The pitch and encaustic of their timbers blazed with fury, abetted by the wind, which turned the debris pile smudge burns into howling bonfires. Alexandros and I had secured a vantage along the landward bluff, no more than a furlong above the site where the mast formations must clash. The smoke was already gagging us. We made our way across the slope. Others had claimed the site before us, boys and older men of Antirion, armed with bows, slings, and missile weapons they meant to hurl down upon the Spartans as they advanced. But these light-armed forces had been cleared early by the Skiritai, whose comrades below would advance, as always, from their position of honor on the Lacedaemonian left. The rangers took possession of half the face, driving the enemy skirmishers back where their slings and shafts were outranged and could work no harm to the army. Directly beneath us, an eighth of a mile away, the Spartans and their allies were marshaling into their ranks. Squires armed the warriors from the feet up, starting with the heavy oxhide soles which could tread over fire, then the bronze greaves, which the squires bent into place around the shins of their masters, securing them at the rear of the calf by the flex of the metal alone. We could see Alexandros's father, Olympius, and the white beard of his squire, Meriones. The troops bound their private parts next, accompanied by obscene humor, as each warrior mock-solemnly saluted his manhood and offered a prayer that he and it would still be acquainted when the day was over. This process of arming for battle, which the citizen soldiers of other poles had practiced no more than a dozen times a year in the spring and summer training, the Spartans had rehearsed and re-rehearsed 200, 400, 600 times each campaigning season. Men in their 50s had done this 10,000 times. It was as second nature to them as oiling or dusting their limbs before wrestling or dressing their long hair, which they, fitted now with the linen spolas corselet and bronze breastplate, proceeded to do with elaborate care and ceremony, assisting one another like a regiment of dandies preparing for a dress ball, all the while radiating an eerie presence of calm and nonchalance. Finally, the men scribed their names or signs upon skutalides, the improvised twig bracelets they called tickets, which would distinguish their bodies should they, falling, be maimed too hideously to be identified. They used wood because it was valueless as plunder by the enemy. Behind the massing men, the omens were being taken. Shields, helmets, and foot-long spear points had been burnished to a mirror's gleam. They flashed brilliantly in the sun, investing the mast formation with the appearance of some colossal milling machine made not so much of men as of bronze and iron. Now the Spartans and Tegeates advanced to their positions in the line. First, the Skiritai on the left, 48 shields across and 8 deep. Next, the Salesian Stephanus, the Laurel Regiment, 1,100 perioikic hoplites. To the right of these massed the 600 heavy infantry of Tegea, then the Agema of the knights in the line's center, Polyneikes prominent among them, 30 shields across and 5 deep, to fight around and protect the person of the king. Right of these,
dressing their line, moved into place the Wild Olive Regiment, 144 across, with the Panther Battalion adjacent the Knights, then the Huntress, with Olympias in the forerank, and the Menelion. On their right, already to their marks, massed the battalions of the Heracles, another 144 across, with Deinikes clearly visible at the head of his 36-man Enomotia, dividing now into 4 9-man files, or Stichoi, anchoring the right. The total, excluding armed squires ranging as auxiliaries, exceeded 4,500. And extended wing to wing across the plain for nearly 600 meters. From our vantage, Alexandros and I could see Decton, as tall and muscular as any of the warriors, unarmored in his altar-boy white, leading 2 she-goats swiftly out to Leonidas, who stood garlanded with the battle-priests before the formation in readiness for the sacrifice. 2 goats were needed in case the first bled inpropitiously. The commander's postures, like those of the massed warriors, projected an air of absolute insouciance. Across from these, the Antirrhionians and their Syracusan allies had massed in their numbers the same width as the Spartans, but 6 or more shields deeper. The scrapyard hulks had now burned down to ashy skeletons, spewing a blanket of smoke across the field. Beyond these, the stones of the harbor sizzled black in the water, while the spikes of burned black wharf timbers protruded from the flotsam-choked surface like burial stones. A clotted ash-colored haze obscured what was left of the waterfront. The wind bore the smoke upon the enemy, upon the massed individuals, the sinews of whose knees and shoulders shivered and quaked beneath the weight of their unaccustomed armor, while their hearts hammered in their breasts and the blood sang in their ears. It took no diviner's gift to discern their state of agitation. "Watch their spear points," Alexandros said, pointing to the massed foe as they jostled and jockeyed into their ranks. "See them tremble. Even the plumes on their helmets are quaking." I looked. In the Spartan line, the iron-bladed forest of 8-footers rose solid as a spike fence, each shaft upright and aligned, dressed straight as a geometer's line and none moving. Across among the enemy, shafts wove and wobbled. All save the Syracusans in the center were misaligned and rank and file. Some shafts actually clattered against their neighbors, chattering like teeth. Alexandros was tallying the battalions in the Syracusans' ranks. He made their total at 2,400 shields, with 1,200 to 1,500 mercenaries and an additional 3,000 citizen militiamen from the city of Antirrhion herself. The enemy's numbers totaled half again that of the Spartans. It was not enough, and the foe knew it. Now the clamor began. Among the enemy's ranks, the bravest, or perhaps the most fear-stricken, began banging the ash of their spear shafts upon the bronze bowls of their shields, creating a tumult of pseudo-Andrea, which reverberated across and around the mountain-enclosed plain. Others reinforced this racket with the warlike thrusting of their spear-points to heaven and the loosing of cries to the gods and shouts of threat and anger. The roar multiplied 3-fold, then 5 and 10, as the enemy rear ranks and flankers picked the clamor up and contributed their own bluster and bronze-banging. Soon the entire 5,400 were bellowing the war cry. Their commander thrust his spear forward, and the mass surged behind him into the advance. The Spartans had neither moved nor made a sound. They waited patiently in their scarlet-cloaked ranks, neither grim nor rigid, but speaking quietly to each other words of encouragement and cheer, securing the final preparation for actions they had rehearsed hundreds of times in training and performed dozens and scores more in battle. Here came the foe, picking up the pace of his advance, a fast walk, a swinging stride.
The line was extending and fanning open to the right, winging out as men in fear edged into the shadow of the shield of the comrade on their right. Already one could see the enemy ranks stagger and fall from alignment as the bravest surged forward and the hesitant shrank back. Leonidas and the priests still stood exposed out front. The shallow stream yet waited before the enemy. The foe's generals, expecting the Spartans to advance first, had formed their lines so that this watercourse stood midway between the armies. In the enemy's plan, no doubt, the sinuous defile of the river would disorder the Lacedaemonian ranks and render them vulnerable at the moment of attack. The Spartans, however, had outweighed them. As soon as the bronze banging began, the enemy commanders knew they could not restrain